one of the narrations, he said, if you want to compare the love of Allah with the love of mother, he loves 90 he loves 90 equal
times.
To 90 yeah wow. 90 times of one mother. So a mother just love you as a mother, but Allah loves us more than a mother.
Right, Sayyid. So just a question I wanted to ask you personally. Do we see religious people, actual religious people, are they usually poor or rich? Because if they're religious people, then Allah would give them more rizq, right? Is this logical to assume, or is this a fallacy?
Well, definitely the religious people have more money, more sustenance, let me say sustenance, than the non-religious people. Why? Because it is the religious people who are the prophets, who are the imams, who are the saints, and they have control of the worlds as well in their hands. So all the treasures of this world or the worlds are in their hands. For example, the Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein are the religious people who are the masters of the paradise.
Right.
Their mothers, as Fatima, the Lady Fatima is the master of all the women of the old world.
Right.
And the Prophet Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad is the cause of the creation of the whole universe.
Right.
Allah has created the whole universe because of them. On the other hand, we have other saints as well. There are many stories about the mystics, Urafa as well, who know how to change the clay into gold and all those. So we have all these things. There are many stories and there are the real things, but obviously we know that the real sustenance,
right,
or being rich is being obedient to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, you will have this world and hereafter.
Can we say, dear Sayyid, on a final note, that you who has weak iman and you are poor, that's the reason?
Yes.
And on that, we will end today's program. I thank you, dear Sayyid, and also thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. Fi amanillah.
Inna fi al-jannati nahran laban. Inna fi al-jannati nahran laban. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن
Communique.
Israel is conducting a targeted campaign against Palestinian prisoners and the organizations defending them. There are currently around 4,600 Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. These figures are from 2020 because Israel refuses to release the real numbers anymore. Around 500 of these Palestinian prisoners are being held in what is called administrative detention. This means they're imprisoned without charge or trial, and they're not even allowed to know why they are in prison because it's secret. At the same time, there are many people fighting for these prisoners' human rights and for their freedom. Palestinian lawyers, human rights activists, NGOs, civil society groups. Israel has attacked these groups for speaking out against its crimes. We know from recent reports that several activists at Palestinian NGOs were spied on after discovering that their mobile phones had been hacked. Their devices were infected with Pegasus, an Israeli cyber weapon. it allows the attacker to turn on the targeted person's microphone, camera, GPS tracking, and view all their messages, photos, and contacts. This spyware, made and sold by an Israeli company, has been used to target journalists, human rights activists, and dissidents all across the world. Israel's actions are not only an affront on the human rights and dignity of Palestinians, which it imprisons without charge or trial, but also an affront on those who defend these prisoners and fight on their behalf. Israel calls itself the only democracy in the Middle East. That's a joke. It couldn't be further from the truth. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The Israeli occupation in Palestine has many tools that it uses daily to oppress Palestinians. One of the most archaic is something called administrative detention. Administrative detention means you go to prison without even being charged with a crime, and there's no trial. The Israelis use this regularly to throw Palestinians in prison, and even if someone is placed in administrative detention, they're not allowed to know why they're in prison. The Israelis keep a secret file, which neither the prisoner nor their lawyer is ever allowed to see. Administrative detention typically lasts 6 months at a time, but can be renewed over and over indefinitely. Every 6 months, the Israelis can just decide to extend the order and keep someone in custody forever if they want. This can typically go on for years. Israel's administrative detention is a violation of the Geneva Convention, because administrative detention by an occupying power is supposed to be used only in extreme cases and on an individual basis. It is not a substitute for a criminal justice system or due process. The Geneva Convention stipulates that in order for administrative detention to be permissible, the person being arrested must pose a significant threat which warrants such detention. Once that threat is gone, the person must be released immediately. Israel doesn't do that. It imprisons people indefinitely and doesn't even tell them why. The way Israel uses administrative detention is not on a case-by-case basis, but as a form of collective punishment. In 2021 alone, the Israelis issued more than 1,500 orders for administrative detention, according to the NGO Ad-Damir. Since 1967, Israel has issued 50,000 administrative orders. This is a clear violation of Article 33 of the Geneva Convention, which prohibits collective punishment. Article 71 of the Geneva Convention says that, quote, no sentence shall be pronounced by the competent courts of the occupying power except after a regular trial. Israel violates this by only placing Palestinians before a military tribunal. There is no regular trial. Article 66 of the Geneva Convention says that prisoners must be sent to a non-political military court located inside the occupied territory. But Israel, again, violates this by sending prisoners to courts located outside the occupied territories. And then another breach. The prisoners are sent to prisons outside the occupied territories, which is in violation of Article 76 under the Geneva Convention. Now, the interesting thing about administrative detention is that it was actually created by the British when Palestine was still a British mandate. In 1945, the Defense Emergency Regulations were enacted, which allowed the British, who occupied Palestine at the time, to establish military courts where civilians could be tried without right of appeal. Sound familiar? British forces could impose curfews, search homes, seize items, any items, and even destroy houses too. The British also gave themselves permission to censor publications and the media. Well, guess what? Israel kept a lot of these so-called laws which were created by the British and imposed on Palestinians. So basically, Palestinians went from living under British colonial rule to living under Zionist colonial rule, with many of the same archaic laws still in place, and a few others amended or repealed. And of course, one of the laws that the Israelis kept from the British was not just the media censor and all the other things, but also the administrative detention, used mainly against Palestinian Arabs, no different than in 1945. Now, joining me to talk more about Palestinian prisoners and administrative detention is Milena Ansari. Milena is an international advocacy officer at Ad-Damir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association, which is a Palestinian non-governmental organization that advocates for Palestinian political prisoners. Milena, thanks for joining us. I'd like to start out with a report that Ad-Damir released in October. You said that there are around 520 Palestinians who are held in administrative detention without charge, without trial. Could you maybe tell us exactly how administrative detention works and how it's used as a form of collective punishment against Palestinians?
As of the 6th of December, there are 500 Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention without trial or charge, including four Palestinian children under the age of 17. The Israeli occupation relies on administrative detention, which is a procedure taken from the British Mandate defense regulations back in 1945. So the basis of this administrative detention goes back to the British Mandate that is still being implemented on the Palestinians. What this administrative detention entails, that the Israeli occupation forces can literally arrest any Palestinian without any charges and without continuing a fair trial for them. And all of this is based on secret material that is most of the time made up by the Israeli Shabak, which is the Israeli security or the intelligence services. What's even more arbitrary regarding this policy is that it does not have a strict limitation or duration. The Israeli occupation can indefinitely hold Palestinians under administrative detention and indefinitely renew their detention without trial or charges. This has created a loophole under the legal system where the Israeli occupation just calls, this person is a threat to the security of Israel, we should detain them for an indefinite time. And we're talking about four Palestinian children under administrative detention that Israel says they impose a risk to the security of the region. What the risk is, nobody knows. Neither the detainee nor the lawyer are allowed to access these secret information, which creates also a psychological torture and ill treatment for the detainees, because they are unaware of the charges that are brought against them, and they are unaware of the duration of the time they will be spending in Israeli prisons under extremely harsh conditions that do not meet the adequate living standards of a basic human life.
There are six Palestinian prisoners who gained a lot of attention recently because of their hunger strike while in administrative detention. They went on hunger strike for many, many months to protest their captivity under administrative detention. Kayed Fesfouz went on hunger strike for 131 days. That's half a year. And his case drew a lot of attention and support from around the world. He ended his hunger strike on November 22nd, 2021, when the Israeli occupation agreed not to renew his administrative detention. He was released on December 14th, 2021. Miqdad Al-Qawasmi ended his hunger strike on November 11th. His hunger strike went on for 113 days. He's set to be released in February 2022. Shadi Abu Akar began his hunger strike on August 25th, 2021. He's been detained by the Israeli occupation, again, without charge or trial, since October 2020. Now, he went on his hunger strike for 69 days, and he suspended it on November 1st, 2021, after the Israeli prison service, the IPS, decided to terminate his detention in April 2022. So that's when he'll be released, according to the Prisoners Affairs Committee. Melina, can you tell us a little bit briefly about how these prisoners began their hunger strike and why it's so important? And what is Abdelmir's role in all this? What are you doing to help these prisoners to support them and everyone who's on hunger strike protesting their administrative detention?
It's important to bear in mind that Palestinian prisoners initiate an ongoing hunger strike as part of the resistance of the Israeli occupation's arbitrary policies. The cases of the six Palestinian prisoners under hunger strike in the past 2 months has highlighted Israel's systematic reliance on administrative detention to detain Palestinians and maintain control over them.
Now, although these men have achieved a somewhat favorable outcome, you know, they're finally out or soon to be released, it's really important to note the toll that such a prolonged hunger strike takes on someone's health. You know, this was a near-death experience for many of these prisoners, and that's the point to which the Israelis drove them. There was a constant fear that these men would die at any moment. They lost so much weight that they would drop in and out of consciousness, their organs were about to fail, you know, they could barely speak or drink water.
the Israeli prison services and the Israeli occupation in specific, they do not care about their health conditions or what implications of the hunger strike is has on their bodies and health and threat to life. They only aim to keep Palestinians in detention. When we're talking about hunger striking detainees reaching 100 plus days, this is not something to take lightly at all. But we've seen the Israeli military system continuing on approving the renewal of administrative detention and freezing the administrative detention order. They will continue to freeze the order, and then when they see the health condition of the prisoner slightly improving, they will re-establish the administrative detention order. So for them, it's a game that the Israeli system, the judicial system, gives legal cover to and allows. The freezing order, it explicitly means that the prisoner is now the responsibility of the hospital and not the Israeli prison services. And this entails additional ill-treatment of the prisoners and detainees.
It's really important to note, however, the game being played here by the Israelis. When we talk about certain prisoners being released, Israel didn't just decide to release them from custody immediately out of compassion or something. You know, Israel still insists that they serve out the entire duration of the detention and only to release them afterwards. So although these men are now free or soon to be free, the Israelis could at any moment rearrest them and throw them back into prison for no reason and keep them there indefinitely. That is the cruelty of administrative detention.
It's important to note that when the military courts freeze the administrative detention, it is in no way does it mean that the detainee is now free or the detainee is not under detention anymore. It only means that the Israeli prison services is not responsible for his life, whatever happens. And the cases of the six Palestinian detainees this time showed us clearly that the Israeli occupation does not care.
There are many Palestinian NGOs and civil society groups who fight on behalf of Palestinian prisoners. On October 25th, 2021, Benny Gantz, the defense minister of the Israeli occupation forces, issued a military order declaring six of these Palestinian civil society groups as terrorist organizations. These six organizations are Al-Damir, Al-Haq, the Bateson Center for Research and Development, Defense for Children International in Palestine, Union of Agricultural Work Committees, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees. The United Nations called Israel's terrorism designation a, quote, unjustified attack on Palestinian civil society. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, issued a statement on October 26th saying that the concerned organizations were some of the most reputable in Palestine and had worked closely with the UN for years. Bachelet said that, quote, claiming rights before a UN or another international body is not an act of terrorism. Advocating for the rights of women in the occupied Palestinian territory is not terrorism. And providing legal aid to detained Palestinians is not terrorism. Now, one of the NGOs outlawed as a terrorist organization by the Israelis is Al-Damir, where our guest Milena works at. Milena, can you tell us what your reaction is to all this when Israel designates six Palestinian human rights groups, including Al-Damir, as terrorist organizations? You know, what is the basis for this kind of accusation? Why do you think the Israelis are doing this?
As a clear answer to your question, I would say there is absolutely no basis for this designation and outlawing six prominent civil society organizations that work in different aspects of the Palestinian life. We have from the six organizations, these organizations work with children, political prisoners, women, farmers and peasants, international reports on the violations of the Israeli occupation, as well as research and documentation. So in a sense, there is absolutely no basis for this. This is part of the Israeli occupation, systematic targeting of civil society organizations to silence them and isolate them from the international community, because they are at the forefront of the organizations that are opposing the systematic and arbitrary policies by the occupation and we are working to change the paradigm like advocate for the rights of Palestinians on different sectors. And most importantly, we are calling the international community to stand against Israel as an apartheid regime and settler colonialism. So in a way, it is mainly to silence our organization, isolate us from the international arena, and discredit our organizations. Many United Nations organizations and international organizations have condemned this action and called that it is not only attack against the Palestinian community, but the whole international community, which is 100% true, because we do legitimate human rights work that Israel is afraid that the international community will see.
And what are some of the other ways that, you know, you've been harassed or intimidated by the occupation forces in your day-to-day operations?
The designation of our organization and further outlawing them in the West Bank is not a single act. It has been, our organization has, organizations have been under attack for several years in this Israeli campaign to silence us. This includes residency revocation. For example, one of Damir's employees, Salah Hamouri, is now the Israeli Interior Minister, approved a decision to revoke his Jerusalem permanent residency because he lives in Jerusalem under the allegation of breach of allegiance to the State of Israel. So in addition to the harassments we face, Israel as an occupying power is expecting us as human rights defenders and lawyers to serve loyalty to this occupying power. Other than residency revocation, there are arbitrary arrests without any basis. And this is what we see that happened with the Palestinian health work committees, where it was also outlawed by Israeli military orders. And following the outlaw, several staff members were arbitrarily arrested. For example, the director, which is a 60-year-old Palestinian woman and human rights defender, Shada Audi. Other than arbitrary arrest, there has been also travel bans on the employees. There has been intimidation and harassment, threats even of murder to the employees and staff. This is all important to understand that these policies are their only aim or goal is to intimidate the defenders of human rights and to make sure that they are in a way to deter any voicing of opposition against the apartheid regime.
Speaking of harassment, here's another interesting revelation. At the same time Israel declared these six Palestinian groups terrorist organizations, it turns out that Israeli spyware was used to hack the mobile phones of the activists and employees at these very same Palestinian NGOs. An investigation by frontline defenders revealed that six employees of the targeted Palestinian groups had had their mobile phones hacked. This included at least one person working for Al-Haq, another for Bison Center, and one for Ad-Damir. Amnesty International and Citizen Lab, who've done extensive work in exposing Pegasus spyware, corroborated these findings. They discovered traces of Pegasus, which is a piece of spyware, a cyber weapon, developed by an Israeli company called NSO Group. Pegasus allows the attacker to do whatever they want with the victim's phone. They can turn on the microphone, the camera, the GPS, and view all their messages, photos, contacts. Frontline defenders suspect that the timing of this terrorism designation after discovery that the phones had been hacked is not a coincidence. Technically, NSO Group, the company that makes and sells Pegasus, claims that it only sells Pegasus to government agencies who are trying to solve serious crimes or deal with counterterrorism. So by declaring these NGOs as terrorists, is the Israeli occupation government trying to somehow justify using Pegasus? Nevertheless, one thing is crystal clear. Israel is doing everything it can, from spying to outlawing these NGOs and Palestinian civil society groups in order to stop them from exposing Israel's human rights abuses and crimes against Palestinians.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time. and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
To give you a better understanding of how cruel administrative detention is, many people have had their detention renewed on the way out of prison. So they would be at the prison gate, ready to leave, ready to go home, thinking that they're free and they can see their family, and then the Israelis tell them that they have to go back into prison again for 6 months. Some people have even been stopped outside the prison, already on the way home. They get pulled over at a checkpoint and told that their administrative detention has been renewed and they must go back to prison. Administrative detention is obviously not just a barbaric and cruel form of punishment, but the toll that it takes on the prisoners and their families, emotionally, psychologically, is tremendous. Someone might be arrested by the Israeli occupation forces and then jailed, and then their parents, their siblings, their partner have all been to prison. It seems that almost every family has had someone imprisoned by the Israeli occupation. Israel calls itself the only democracy in the Middle East. Israel isn't a democracy at all. How can you be a democracy when you randomly throw people in prison without telling them why they're in prison, and then you refuse to charge them or try them? What kind of a legal process is that? That's not even a kangaroo court. It's just barbaric. How is that any different from what the United States does to people in Guantanamo Bay, where it imprisons men for years without ever charging them or convicting them of a crime? These are the kinds of practices that the Americans and Israelis accuse other countries of doing. They accuse the Arabs, the Iranians, the Russians of doing this, but they themselves are complicit in this behavior. The Israelis and Americans act like they're civilized and democratic and they're better than everyone else, as if everyone else comes from the jungle and just doesn't get it. But look at their behavior. Look at what Israel and the United States do, and you will find a lot of hypocrisy and a lot of authoritarianism. Administrative detention is a cruel, barbaric practice. It doesn't just hurt the prisoner, it hurts their family as well. There's no such thing as Israeli justice. There is no justice for Palestinians. There is only a brutal military occupation that exists to protect a racist settler colony that steals land from Palestinians and kills them or imprisons them when they try to resist. Administrative detention is a leftover colonial practice from the British Empire. How fitting that the Israelis kept it to use it against Palestinians. It's just further proof that Israel is a British creation. Palestinians essentially went from living under British colonial rule to living under Zionist colonial rule, with many of the same archaic laws still in place. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
birthday of the Most Blessed Mother. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Heartiest felicitations to you on a very special day. Today, Mother's Day is being celebrated in the Islamic Republic of Iran, as well in countries and societies where women and motherhood are viewed from the standpoint of virtue, with respect, attached to them as the basic builders of sound and healthy societies. In sharp contrast to the decadent Western culture, where women are considered carnal and commercial commodities, Islam has designated a lofty position for the daughters of Eve in view of its emphasis on morally upright ladies from the beginning of creation, such as Sarah, the wife of Prophet Abraham, Mary, the mother of Prophet Jesus, and Khadija, the wife of the Prophet of Islam, with the noblest of them all being Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, whose birthday we are celebrating today on the 20th of Jamadi Uthani. Stay with us for a special feature on this most exemplary lady, the Immaculate Daughter of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger to all mankind, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In ayahs 58 and 59 of Surah Nahl of the Noble Quran, God Almighty relates to us part of the sorry state of affairs of the pre-Islamic society of Arabia that had degraded females to the worst ever position. When one of them is brought the news of a female newborn, his face becomes darkened and he chokes with suppressed agony. He hides from the people out of distress at the news he has been brought. Shall he retain it in humiliation or bury it in the ground? Look, evil is the judgment that they make. The ayahs that we recited to you depict the state of anguish and horror of a non-Muslim society at the birth of a daughter. The father is shocked at what he views as ignominy to him and his family. He is perplexed. He doesn't know what to do or what evil to commit against the newborn girl. The questions are, why should the father be shocked? Isn't the daughter a human being? Of course she is, but for a variety of reasons, he shudders at what awaits her when she grows up. Irrespective of the burden of dowry he may have to procure for at the time of her marriage, he's more worried about the dishonor she may bring for him and his tribe by being exploited by men of other clans, whether or not he had treated the daughters of other people with respect. This disrespect for women was not restricted to the Arabs of the days of ignorance. It was in fact widespread in the supposedly civilized nations of the past and continues till this day in the modern world, despite the loud claims of women's rights, which are mostly ill-defined and are in fact in distortion of feminine virtues. In other words, because of the un-Islamic nature of the society, where often the rights of the females are denied, the prime cause of anguish is commercialization of women and their treatment as mere objects of carnal desires, and all these in the name of freedom and liberties. The other reasons of distress of fathers and parents whose hearts are devoid of true Islamic belief, even if they pay lip service to Islam, is the prospect of parting with family wealth as inheritance to her that would reduce the share of the sons. Still, in the case of those who have no proper cognizance of the infinite wisdom of God, the Almighty Creator, let alone acquaintance with the letter and spirit of the dynamism of Islam, the main reason of sadness at the birth of a daughter, especially when there is no son, is the horrifying thought of the end of lineage, for it is males who are considered the means of continuation of progeny. Thanks to Islam, all such notions regarding daughters were changed for good. For the first time in history, women found themselves placed on the pedestal of dignity and honor. Since the laws of God neither allow the abuse and commercialization of women as objects of carnal desire, nor do they impose excessive burden on the parents regarding dowry. All the same time, women have the right to education, the right to own property, the right to choose the spouse, the right to be active in social spheres, and the right to inherit and in turn pass an inheritance to children. They possess all these and several other rights, including the freedom of wearing the hijab and the liberty of being attired in modest clothing while in public, in order not to attract unnecessary and unwarranted attention from strangers. The hijab or the modest attire with head covering grants women freedom and liberty in the real sense of these terms, and with a dignity and respect in society that gives meaning to life. As the other half of mankind, it is the woman who, in addition to providing peace and solace to the husband, plays the fundamental role in building a sound and healthy society by bringing up children in the proper manner on the basis of faith and moral values, factors that rule out immorality and with it any agonizing thoughts for parents. That was the reason Prophet of Islam told one of the new Muslim Arabs who frowned on receiving news of the birth of a daughter to him, "The earth bears her, the heavens shade her, and the Almighty gives her food. For you, she is like a flower. Smell her fragrance." On another occasion, in order to remove misconceptions from the society, the Prophet marked 12 graces descend over the person's house where there are daughters. Heavenly blessings are showered on that house, and angels visit that house for a glimpse. The Almighty's greatest messenger was not a mere preacher, but a practical demonstrator of whatever the all-wise Creator revealed to him for the good of mankind. He set the personal example, and it is for this reason the Noble Quran calls him the excellent exemplar. Thus, on the 20th of Jamadi Thani, Divine Providence decided to reward Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, with the greatest of perpetual gifts. After he and his beloved wife, Hazrat Khadija, the Ummul Mu'mineen, or mother of all true believers, peace upon her, lost their two sons, Qasim and Tahir, in infancy. The pagan Arabs, such as Asib Nabil, tried to mock the Prophet as Abtar, which literally means tailless, and refers to the one without progeny. They thought the name of the person whose mission they had no belief would soon disappear and die out, while their ill-begotten brats would guarantee the continuation of their lineage. How wrong were they? To the bewilderment of these retarded minds, God not only granted the prophets a radiant daughter, conceived of the fruit of paradise he ate during his mi'raj, or physical ascension to the heavens and back to planet Earth in a fraction of a night, but as the following surah bears testimony, the perpetuity of his blessed offspring, similar to the perennially inexhaustible fountain of Kothar. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, indeed, we have granted you Kothar. So pray to your Lord and offer sacrifice. Indeed, it is your enemy who is without posterity. The hypocrites amongst the Muslims might deny that Kothar refers to the Prophet's impeccable daughter, the noblest ever lady of all times, or Sayyidatun Nisa al-Alamin min al-Awwalin wal-Akhirin. But, as is obvious by the last part of this surah, which says, indeed your enemy is without posterity, Kothar is undoubtedly a reference to Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, whose progeny has multiplied and spread all over the world, while that of his enemies has long disappeared. Today, as we celebrate Mother's Day in the Islamic Republic of Iran and other Islamic societies abroad, in honor of the infallible mother who gave to the world such all-time perfect sons and daughters like Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, Hazrat Zainab, and Hazrat Kulthum, peace upon them, let us refer to a hadith from the Prophet mentioned in the books of our Sunni brethren, such as Sahih Bukhari, Sahih Muslim, Musnad Ibn Hanbal, etc., regarding Kothar and its connection to the person without whom the Prophet's only daughter would have remained an unmarried, like the Virgin Mary. Kothar is a stream of super excellence exclusively belonging to me. Only the righteous believers among my followers will be allowed to drink from it. Ali, peace upon him, will distribute water from it to them. On the day of judgment, I will see some of my companions driven like the cattle away from Kothar. It will be announced that they are those who, after my departure from the world, deviated from the true religion and introduced innovations to corrupt the faith. It is recorded that from that day onwards, one of the epithets of Imam Ali, peace upon him, became Saqiyul Kothar, meaning the one who quenches the thirst of believers at the heavenly stream of Kothar, and the one who is the husband of Kothar, that is, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, in whose honor God has revealed several ayahs of the Noble Quran. How can mortals pen the merits of the Immaculate Daughter of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, the impeccable wife of the commander of all the true believers, the infallible mother of the leaders of the youth of paradise, and the exceptional teacher of all those girls and women eager to achieve feminine virtue as they strive towards the proximity of the loving creator of the universe. During childhood, Fatima peace upon her, whose spiritual glories kept her above material matters, had so dedicatedly taken care of her widowed father that she earned the epithet of Umabiha, or mother of her father. This concept and this demonstration of fatherly and daughterly love was to revolutionize society. Thus, the virtues of Hazrat Fatima, peace upon her, are not solely related to paradise in afterlife or the day of judgment, on when she will intercede in the divine court for the forgiveness of multitudes of the faithful who had erred, but are ubiquitous in the transient world, since she is the pivotal figure of the blessed group whom God calls Ahlul Bayt in Ayah 33 of Surah Ahzab of the Noble Quran, and whose blessings cover all aspects of our life and faith. Indeed, Allah desires to keep away uncleanness from you, Ahlul Bayt, and preserve you thoroughly purified. Time does not permit us to go into details of this ayah or of ayah 61 of Surah Al-Imran, on the revelation of which the Prophet took his daughter as the only female along with her husband and two sons, and no one else besides, for the unique challenge of Mubahaleh with the Christians of Najran that marked the resounding triumph of Islam. No wonder the Redeemer of mankind, who will reappear in the end times as Imam Mahdi al-Qa'im, peace upon him, to establish the global government of peace, prosperity and justice, is the direct descendant of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to The Key on IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question that a lot of people bring up and mention. This question is especially brought up by adherents and followers of other sects within Islam, besides the followers of the Shiite sect who follow the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhimus salam. The question is this: is it permissible to mourn the friends of God, the death of the friends of God, the martyrdom of the friends of God? Is it permissible to cry for them? To be more specific, a lot of people say that these acts are instances of bid'at, or innovation in religion. In order to answer this question, we need to take a look at the meaning of bid'at. When we look at the meaning of bid'at, we see that this term, which is a religious term, and because of this we need to turn to the traditions in order to gain a better understanding of what it means, and to gain a precise understanding of what it means, we see that the word bid'at is contrasted with the word sunnah. Therefore, a bid'at is something that doesn't have any foundation in the sunnah and the norms of the Prophet, the traditions of the Prophet, regardless of whether that is the acts of the Prophet, the words of the Prophet, or even the indirect acceptance of others' actions by the Prophet. When we look at these, the act of mourning other people, other people's death or their martyrdom, grieving for them, mourning for them, crying for them, we see that, in fact, it does have a basis in the tradition of the Prophet, and therefore it cannot be categorized in under the heading of bid'at. One tradition which is particularly interesting is regarding the death of Hazrat Hamza. Hazrat Hamza, who was the first martyr of Islam, one of the first martyrs of Islam. In a tradition, after the martyrdom of Hazrat Hamza, and in the battle in which he was martyred, and in which a lot of other Muslims had also been martyred, the Ansar, the helpers, who were a group of companions of the Prophet, they were busy mourning and crying for their loved ones who had also died in this battle. This indirectly indicates also that this act of mourning and crying for one's loved ones and the friends of God also has a basis in the actions of the companions of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. When the Prophet heard this, the Prophet was saddened. He said, "However, Hamza, there is no one to cry for you." When the people heard this, the women of the Ansar, the companions, the helpers, they came to the Prophet, the door of the house of the Prophet, and they began to lament and cry for Hamza. When the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam heard this, he prayed for the well-being of these women. And then he told them, he asked them to leave. He said, "Thank you for your gesture. You may please leave from here." From then, and this is interesting, from then on, whenever a dead body or a dead person from the Ansar was brought, the women of the Ansar would first cry for Hazrat Hamza, and then they would cry for their loved ones. In other words, the women of the Ansar made it a tradition, you know, going back to this event, they made it a tradition for themselves that before they would cry for anybody, they would cry and lament for Hazrat Hamza. They would bring him up and mention him, and then they would cry for their own loved ones. This tradition has been mentioned in the book Tabaqat Ibn Sa'd, volume 2, page 44. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the permissibility of crying and mourning and grieving for one's loved ones and the friends of God and the traditions of the Prophet. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on RIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.